We are ready for Luke chapters 5 and 6. We have some ground to cover. These are long chapters for those who are either visiting with us or watching. And there are a number of people who watch from time to time online as these are posted later. This is a Bible survey, meaning we're going through the entire Bible in a five-year period. So thus the pace at which we are going. And so we're trying to cover chapters 5 and 6. Luke chapters 5 and 6. This is the outline we're following. We borrow from Baxter. We're in the Gospel in Galilee section as he has outlined it here. And so he is dealing with the Galilean ministry, where we saw Mark got to that rather quickly because of the fast pace with which he writes. And Matthew took a little more time to get to that. So that's where we are. Let's review our chapters. Chapter 1. Birth of John and the announcement concerning Jesus and his birth. Chapter 2, birth of Jesus and the childhood of Jesus. Chapter 3, preaching of John the Baptist. And then last week, chapter 4, temptation and the beginning of his ministry. Now that's where this Galilean ministry begins. And so we're continuing that ministry here in chapter 5. Let's go to question number 1 for today, main point of chapter 5. All right, here's the Galilean ministry, and what's he do at the beginning of his ministry, as he did in the other accounts? He calls the disciples together. There are miracles that are mentioned here, but chapter 5, calling of the first disciples and miracles, I call the chapter. We have the calling of Matthew, but before that we have Peter, James, and John are called to be followers and be his disciples. And then chapter 6, we take these disciples that he's called, and he chooses them and names them as apostles. Make sense? That's what's being accomplished. Chapter 6 is going to also deal with, if we want to jump ahead to question 7, it deals also with the calling of the disciples and what else? A major event. Sermon on the Mount. A smaller version of that than we have recorded in Matthew, where? You tell me. Chapters 5, 6, and 7. All right. And so that's our go-to section to find out what was found in the Sermon on the Mount. However, Luke is going to insert some things that are not found in Matthew 5, 6, or 7, and we'll flag that as we go along. All right, let's get underway. Chapter 5, beginning at verse 1. This is the miraculous catch of fish found in verses 1 through 11. And as a multitude pressed about him to hear the word of the Lord, he stood by the lake of Gennesaret, the text says. Well, what is the lake of Gennesaret? Well, that's the Sea of Galilee. The land that was south of Capernaum, Capernaum is here at the northern end of the Sea of Galilee. The land that was to the south and on the western side was often referred to as Gennesaret. Thus, the Lake of Gennesaret would be the Sea of Galilee. The sea itself was often referred to as the Sea of Tiberias. So we take it that it's on this shore over here, somewhere along this shore, is where this scene takes place. Now, what does he find when he gets there? Saw two boats. Both of them are empty. They're fishermen, which included Peter, James, and John. There's the father that's not mentioned here, but mentioned in Matthew 4, who was a part of the team. And what else does he find them doing? Washing their nets. What does that indicate to you? They're done. They're finished. They have no intention of using them again that night. So they fished all night, and they've caught nothing. And they're washing their nets. They're done, they're finished, they're through. Now, let's make a parallel to that. Let's imagine you are a fisherman and you're out at the lake and you have fished for hours and hours and hours and you've caught nothing. You've tried every bait you have and you've caught nothing. And you pull the boat in and put it on the trailer and you get all your tackle and you've got it back in the box and you've got your rods and reels and you're putting them back in their place. What does that indicate? You're done, you're finished. And suppose I came along and said, if you'll take your line and cast it out one more time, I think you'll catch something. What would be your reaction? Done. You're crazy. After all, these are professional fishermen, aren't they? And here is a carpenter that comes along and says to them, launch out into the deep. So let's look at verse 3. He got into the boat and he taught, put out a little from the land. He taught the multitude, and when he had stopped speaking, what the content of the message was, we're not told. But I know it was the gospel of the kingdom, according to chapter 4 and verse 23. And then he says to them, launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch. And what does Peter say? Yeah, we fished all night long and we've caught nothing. That suggests, I'm not sure about this. There seems to be some question. We fished all night and we haven't found a thing out there. Notice this word, nevertheless. BDAG says it means in spite of. In spite of that, in spite of the fact that we haven't caught a thing, we fished all night, we've had two boats, we've had all these nets, and we've caught nothing, at your word, I'll let down the net. Do you think he has confidence in the Lord? Well, yeah. What did he see in the previous chapter? Peter's mother-in-law had been healed. He knows there can be miracles, but it's not sinking. Remember, we talked in Mark about the dullness of the disciples. They hadn't quite got the full picture yet. But be that as it may, nevertheless, at your word, I'll let down the net. So what happened, verse 6? They let down the net, and what happened? Yeah, they filled one boat, they motioned for the others to come, they filled the other boat, and both boats began to sink. That's quite a catch. Wasn't it? They just had a successful night. This was the most successful night they'd ever had. And then he says, then what happens? Verse 8. Depart from me, for I'm very good. A sinful man, O Lord. Why would he say that? We have a question on that. Question number 3. Why would he say that? Exactly. He's seen miracles before. We know that from chapter 4. This seems to be a turning point. It is not that I don't want to be around you. Depart from me. I want you away from me. It's not that he's afraid of Jesus, but depart from me because I'm unworthy to be in your presence, one who could work a miracle like this. This is a turning point for Peter. And so he says, depart from me. It's a deep humility. For he and all that were with him were astonished at the great catch of fish. And so were also James and John. And what did Jesus say to them at verse 10? All right, this is the call. You're going to be followers of me and you're going to catch men. So when they brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. Now, the all includes their boats and their family. You say, how do you know? Matthew 4:22 will tell you that. They left their father and their boats and their business. Now, here's the picture I wanted you to see. That had this been done when they're washing their nets, they've been unsuccessful. Hey, how about giving that up, this business of fishing up, and come and be a part of the business I'm in, and let's go catch men. They might have been willing to do that, because this isn't working too well anyway, this fishing business. Look how sorry it was tonight. No, we're not going to do that. We might give that up. But after they'd had the greatest success they'd ever had in their life, they were told, now give all of that up and come and follow me. Now, that's a challenge. Now, I don't have time to get into this. This is from a sermon I have done repeatedly in meetings called Nevertheless from Luke chapter 5 that we learned from that we need to obey even if it seems unreasonable. You think that seemed unreasonable to Peter? Absolutely it did. And yet he did it anyway. Jesus was saying, try even if it seems impossible. It would seem impossible casting your nets again. In other words, if the fish weren't out there, they're not going to be out there when we cast again. That seems impossible. But cast out anyway. Launch out into the deep. We need to do the same thing. We need to continue on even if we're weary. You think they were tired? You think they were weary, fished all night? Well, go out and cast again. You say, well, I'm tired. Well, cast out again. Keep going. There's a lesson about being humble even if it's hard. That must have been hard for Peter to be this humble, because remember, he was always the one that was the out front man, speaking up first. And his name had to surface at the top of who is the greatest a little bit later. And yet he's so humble, he says, I want you to depart from me. And then we need to forsake all, even if what we're forsaking is important. Powerful lessons from Luke 5. Make sense? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Keep on pressing on, even if we indeed are weary. All right, now let's move on and talk about the healing of the leper and what we learn from this and the timing of it and some comparisons to make to Matthew's account. For what it's worth to you, Matthew 8 mentions this beginning at verse 2 through 4, but Matthew puts this after the Sermon on the Mount. Mark puts it before the Sermon on the Mount. Now, and so what that tells me is true chronology is not always as important as telling the story and fitting the story into the storylines. That makes sense? Because that's what Matthew did. That's what Mark did. Luke is more chronological, but there is some chronology that's not in sequence as we seem to have it in other accounts that where we know the sequence is what it should be. And we'll see more about that perhaps in chapter 6. But anyway, there was this man who came full of leprosy, and he made a request. And what was it? And he was willing. And he said to him, be cleansed. Then what happened? Immediately. What do you make of that? As far as any miracles of the present day, so-called. This was immediate, instant. It wasn't that he begins to get better and he's improving. The doctors say, well, I think he's going to be okay in a few months. Just give him time, but none of this was immediate, and the leprosy is gone. Unheard of. Now, notice at verse 14, he charged him to tell no one. Now, we flag this in Matthew. You may have a note back over in Matthew 9 and in verse 30. It's the similar point, not the same event, but the time was not yet fulfilled, not for the full declaration, nor was his work that of healing. That wasn't his work. That's merely evidence and the throngs of people that it would invite. And so he tells him, don't go tell anyone, but go show yourself to the priest. Now, what's the idea of going to the priest? As part of the old law. We just studied that in Leviticus. So Leviticus 14 talks about this principle. You go and present yourself to the priest, make your offering, and etc. So what's the point of that? The point of that is without going to the priest, the testimony, I've been healed of my leprosy, is of no significance and means nothing. So that's more evidence that a true miracle has been done. This man is a leper. He comes to Jesus. He's healed. Go to the priest, and the priest examines and looks. You don't have any signs of leprosy. You don't have any symptoms of leprosy. It's not getting better. It's gone. And so he has the certificate of the priest. In other words, the pronouncement of the priest. I don't mean a literal certificate. But it's as if I've got a certificate signed and stamped by the priest. The priest says, I'm cleansed of my leprosy. But I know you were a leper. I saw you with leprosy. But here's my proof. That's proof of the miracle. Does that make sense? Proof of his claims. All right, let's talk about the healing of the paralytic. Before we leave that, let's go to verse 16. Luke adds this point, that he often withdrew and to the wilderness and prayed. What do you learn from that? All right, even Jesus needed time with God. What else? Yes, he made and scheduled time for prayer. You might flag chapter 6, verse 12 at the end of this verse to go over there and look as you study that in the future, because that's exactly what he did in Luke 6 and 12. That's what he did in Mark 1:35, that he went into a solitary place and there he prayed, went to the mountain to pray. He often did that, the text says, that if Jesus, the Son of God, needed to spend time in prayer, then the conclusion is we do too. All right, let's talk about the healing of the paralytic I should have changed that on the screen. The previous section should be through verse 16, and now this healing of the paralytic should be 17 through 26. But be that as it may, we're close. What we have here is there was a certain man that happened on a certain day, that as he was teaching, where the Pharisees and teachers of the law setting by, They came from every town. Doesn't tell where he was here. But where is this taking place? Well, according to Matthew's account, Matthew 9, 1 through 8, and we'll flag some things as we go back over there and make some comparison, that seemed to be Capernaum. And you say, well, I turn over to Matthew 9 in verse 1, and it doesn't say Capernaum. It just says his own city. Well, jump back from there. You may have a flag at chapter 9 and 1 of Matthew that chapter 4 and 13 of Matthew says Capernaum was that city. So that's why it's helpful to flag verses together for what it may be worth to us. So this is probably taking place at Capernaum. Now, what takes place in this story? All right, perhaps a mud roof, a grass roof, a flat kind of roof. So it's, if you're picturing a metal roof or an asphalt roof, as we would have, a little difficult. But a mud or a grass roof where they could climb up onto the roof and then easily work a hole into that. So they let the man down in the midst of the crowd because of the crowd being there. And here's a man that can't walk, and they let him down in the midst. Now, look at verse 20, when Jesus saw their faith, not the man's faith. He's talking about the ones that bore him and brought him, that they had enough faith that if we can just, we'll go to the trouble of breaking open the roof rather than saying, well, the crowd is too busy. We can't get in there. We can't get in. But we'll take him up on the roof, tear a hole in the roof, and let him down. Jesus will do something. And so when he saw their faith, he said, man, your sons are forgiven you. Now, what was the reaction? Yeah, your sins are forgiven you. Now, what was the reaction?
They were aggravated because they said he was blaspheming. Who can forgive men other than God?
Yeah, exactly. This man's claiming to do something only a divine person can do, and Jesus is setting him up for something. So then he asks, what question? Well, before he asks a question, verse 22. He perceived their thoughts. What does that tell you? He could read their minds and their hearts, which is evidence of his deity. And so he asks them a question, verse 23. Which is easier to say, your sins be forgiven you, or rise and walk? We have a question about that. Question number 5. What does that mean? Absolutely. It would be easier to make a claim, I can forgive sins, your sins be forgiven you. How do you know whether that's done or not? Do I have the power to do that? So that's easier to say. It's harder to say, rise and walk, because you've got to provide some proof of that. You've got to see some result of that. That's something where we're going to see a change. And so they think perhaps they've got him because, well, he just said then, and so he's going to give the power. Now, here's another evidence. Look at verse 24. But that you may know the Son of Man has power on earth to forgive sins. Now, many have thought that the expression Son of God refers to his deity, and it does. And the Son of Man refers to his humanity, and it does. But it also refers to his deity. And you say, how do you know? Because Daniel 7, 14 prophesies the Son of Man coming and ascending to the Ancient of Days. So that's the Messiah, that's deity, the Son of God. So when Jesus made a claim of being the Son of Man, not only was he claiming to be humanity, he's also claiming to be deity. Does that make sense? So if I were going to argue for the deity of Christ, one of the things I would find is all those references to being the Son of Man. That's part of the evidence. Powerful point. Now what does he do at verse 24? He told the man, rise and walk, and the man immediately got up and walked. So what did he just prove? He proved two things. He proved that he could work miracles, and if he could do that, then he could forgive sins. So we saw four evidences right there. One is he perceived their thoughts, and they had to know that. He can forgive sins. He can work miracles. And he claimed to be the Son of Man. And if he could work the miracle, he is the Son of Man. So that the story of the healing of the paralytic is packed full of evidences of Jesus. Now, at verse 20, they were filled with fear, and they said what? We've seen incredible or strange things today. Mark 1's account said, we've never seen anything like this. Well, I guess not. We've never seen anything like this. A man being let down and he told immediately rise and walk, and he did. And a man who perceived our thoughts and a man who claimed to be the Son of God. We've never seen anything like this. This is strange. This is different. This is incredible. All right. Let's move on to the calling of Matthew in verses 27 through 30. If you want to flag Matthew 9 and in verse 9, here he's identified as Levi, but we know Levi referred to the man we know as Matthew. Matthew 9 and in verse 9. Mark 2 is also a parallel account. What do you see in this story?
Matthew was a publican. He was hated among the Jews because he did the work of the Gentiles, plus some of the publicans took money for themselves.
All right. Couple of things that mention here that, good comments, that are not mentioned in the parallel accounts. One is he left all, verse 28, and rose up and followed him. Same thing Peter, James, and John did. Left everything they had. And so this is a powerful point. Quite often we're willing to follow the Lord, but I'm not willing to give up everything. I'll give up something, but I won't give it all up. With Matthew, with Peter, James, and John, they were willing to give up anything and everything that was necessary to follow the Lord. The second thing is, this is not a big deal, but verse 29, Matthew's account mentions there was a feast that Matthew was present at, but Luke tells us it was a feast in his own house, and he had this feast, and the Pharisees murmured, why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners, and what was Jesus' answer to that? You don't need a doctor or physician if you're well. It's those that are sick. So you might make a marginal note. We did this in Matthew. I think we did it in Mark. Let's do it again in Luke. Here is a summary of his mission. Jesus is trying. This is the beginning part of his ministry. And what he's trying to tell his disciples and the world, this is what I'm about. This is my mission. He's not trying to bring social justice to an unjust society. He's trying to bring salvation. And so these people are spiritually sick, and I'm trying to bring salvation to them. This is my mission. Now look at verse 32. He came not to call the righteous, but the sinners to repentance, suggests the idea of compassion, that he's coming to do his work with compassion. All right, now let's move on and finish this chapter by dealing with why the disciples do not fast. We've seen this in Matthew, we've seen this in Mark, but Luke adds a little information, a little different twist to it that we haven't seen, so we'll get to that here in a second. At least I don't remember seeing it. Maybe we did. So why do the disciples not fast? The Pharisees asked the question that John's disciples fast often and make prayers, and likewise the Pharisees, but yours eat and drink. Perhaps like we just saw at Matthew's house. And y'all are sitting at a feast, but the Pharisees fast often. Well, you remember in Luke 18, remember the Pharisee and the publican? What did the Pharisee say? I fast twice a week. Fast twice a week. That was usually, according to Hastings, as quoted from Stouffer in his commentary on Mark, that was usually on Monday and Thursday. That's not as important as the fact that they fasted often, the text said. And John's disciples apparently fasted. The text says so. How did Jesus respond to that? Question number six. Yeah, this is not the time. It's inappropriate. You do that when the bridegroom is gone. Now, let's look at a couple of things because Luke shifts something toward the end that we'll get to in a moment. By the way, Fasting was commanded one time in the Old Testament, and that was on the Day of Atonement. Leviticus chapter, not 15, not 17. Ah, there we go, there we go. All right. Yeah, we just dealt with that Wednesday. And Leviticus 16 had to do with the Day of Atonement. It was only commanded one time. Never commanded in the New Testament. Do we find it in the New Testament? Sure. But here is a case, like at verse 35, fasting was an effect or result and not something that God commanded to be done, that I'm going to fast because God told me to. Does that make sense? So do we ever fast? Well, sure you do. You ever distraught over a problem or a death or sickness, or you're just down about something and you don't feel like eating, and you may go for several hours without eating, maybe a day without eating. You were fasting. And that's how it's mentioned even here in this context. But anyway, here's his point. That in interest of time, I just want to hit verse 34 and 35, that you don't fast while the bridegroom is there. You fast when he is gone. It's not time for them to fast. When I'm gone, they're going to be distraught. But I'm with them. So it's inappropriate for them to fast right now. All right? That's illustration number one. The second is, and some think that the next two illustrations are separate and apart from the first one. I still think it carries the idea of being inappropriate. Let's approach it that way, and then I'm going to come back and add another thought. The second illustration is repairing a garment. Here is a garment that has been washed and shrunk. It's an old garment, and you need to repair. What do you not do? Yeah, you don't repair that with new cloth because then it's going to pull away and tear and it's ruined. Again, that's inappropriate. He's trying to answer why they don't fast. A third illustration is that of putting new wine into old wineskins. Now, you may have some notes over in Matthew. If you want to turn over there to Matthew chapter 9. I'll find it here in a second. Beginning at verse 14, we may have flagged. Barnes suggests, for what this is worth, that this refers to the process of fermentation. You put new wine in, you don't put them into wineskins that have stretched with fermentation, because then they stretch further than they burst. And I've always thought that's what that means. Kyle Pope presents another idea, and I've flagged this for you before, that it's not talking about that, but it's talking about you put it in new wineskins to prevent fermentation. Because the old wineskins may be contaminated with some process of fermentation that would then cause the new wine to easily ferment. Well, it's not a big deal which way that is. The point is, it's inappropriate to put wine into old wineskins. You put it into new wineskins. And so we won't get into all the details of that. Just saying that those are two different possibilities. Again, I think he's talking about what's not appropriate. However, those two last illustrations, Caldwell and Willis, both in their works on Luke, suggest that he's saying you don't mix the old with the new as well as being inappropriate. You don't take the religion of the Pharisees, the old, and mix that with the new, with the religion of Christ. It don't mix. And then flags that with verse 39. Here's something that we're seeing, kind of new information. And no one, having drunk old wine, immediately desires the new, for he says the old is better. Now that may again refer to that which is inappropriate, but both of those references, works that I just mentioned, that it's a target at warning the Pharisees, you're not going to accept the new revelation from Jesus because you're content with the old. You're not interested in what I've got to say. You're not interested in my revelation. You're not interested in evidence that I present to you. You're interested in your old ways, such as fasting, such as demanding fasting, such as eating with washed hands, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Make sense? Now, flag that for what it's worth. We don't have time to pursue that much further because we want to cover chapter 6. But I pass that on for what that's worth to you. Let's go to chapter 6 now. And in chapter 6, we have the calling of the disciples and the Sermon on the Mount. So let's go to chapter 6. Now, depending on your edition of your New King James, if you have that, your translation may say at verse 1. Now it happened on the second Sabbath after the first that he went through the grain field. And you say, I've got it. I just read from the New King James. You look at your New King James, you said mine reads different. I've mentioned this multiple times. The New King James is updated every year. So it depends on what year yours came out. The newer editions of the New King James will say that it was on another Sabbath. Your English Standard says that. And so do other translations. I think that's the idea here. That there was another Sabbath that he came and his disciples were eating grain. And what's now the question? Yeah, why are they doing that which is not lawful on the Sabbath? By the way, this is a classic case where Luke is mentioning things out of sequence. Probably mentions it here to show Jesus is Lord of the Sabbath. But Matthew doesn't mention this to chapter 12. And we without giving evidence now, and I don't have time, that probably Matthew's account is the more chronological one on this, that this comes in at Matthew 12. So, but he mentions it out of sequence. But anyway, how does Jesus answer that when that your disciples are doing that which is not lawful? Yeah, he mentioned some things of the past. What'd you say?
I was going to say, jumping ahead, I guess, that he would tell them that they didn't have a problem with what David did, if they did what these disciples did.
Excellent point. So let's talk a little about this just for a moment. And then we're going to have to move on to, I want us to see if we can get an overview of some the rest of the chapter in the few minutes we have. Look at verse 4, that he mentions David did that which was not lawful. Some think that, he might underline that, and then get ready to turn over to Matthew 12, and we're going to flag some things there, because Matthew 12, 7 is going to be a key to understanding any of the parallel accounts on this. Some think that what Jesus is saying is, hey, they may have violated the law. Big deal. David did too. Big deal. That's not what Jesus is saying. He's actually focusing on their inconsistency. Did the disciples do wrong? No. Did the disciples sin and had they violated the law of Moses? No. I'm going to give evidence of that here in a moment. Did David do wrong? Is he saying, well, David did it and it was okay? No. David did wrong. How do I know David did wrong? Look at verse 4 of our text in Luke 6. David did that which was lawful? Not lawful. It's only for the priest. I'll take Jesus at his word. David did what was not lawful. Well, what about the disciples? Let's go to Matthew 12, and in verse 7, he refers to them as being, look at the end of verse 7. Guiltless. Doesn't sound like wrong. I think what he's doing is flagging their inconsistency. That David did wrong, y'all don't have a problem with that. The disciples did not do wrong, and you do have a problem with that. He's showing they're inconsistent. You don't really care about the law, because if you did, you'd say David did wrong. But no, y'all don't have a problem with David, but you do have a problem when somebody doesn't violate the law because he violated your tradition. Now, we're going to have to leave that and move on. Let's talk about the healing of the man with a withered hand. Luke mentions his right hand. None of the other accounts mention that. And this was a question. As you parallel the accounts, Matthew's account mentions one thing, Mark mentions something else in Luke. But on one occasion, they asked Jesus, is it lawful to heal? On another, another account, Jesus asked them, which way was it? Yes. Both. Because if both are recorded, both happen. He both asked them and they asked him. And notice at verse 11, here's what I wanted to flag on that one. They were filled with rage and discussed what they wanted to do. Matthew and Mark mentioned they wanted to kill him. You might flag that. This is the first reference. Now, I'm discounting Matthew and Mark because we're picturing as if we start with the beginning of the birth of Christ on through chronologically. This is our first reference to their intent to kill him. We haven't seen that before. And so we know that from Matthew's account, Mark's account, parallel accounts. And I notice also they're ignoring the evidence. Now let's go to verse 12. Jesus prayed all night. He went to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer unto God. A lot of lessons to learn. He made time for prayer. He scheduled time for prayer. Was that one continuous prayer? Was that several different prayers? I don't know, but he prayed all night. Now I had a question here, and so I'm going to, in interest of time, rather than ask it, just give you the answer. Verse 11. What's implied as we go to the next verse? He must have been praying about these disciples, choosing the disciples. And he said, how do you know? Because he prayed all night, and then the very next thing he did was go and choose 12, whom he named apostles. He prayed before an important decision. Prayed all night. Maybe we need to do much the same thing. Then I'm going to skip over 17 through 19. That's just a multiplicity of healings. So he healed a number of people. That's not that that's unimportant, but I want to move to the Sermon on the Mount. There's the Beatitudes section. Now, this is a brief summary where three chapters are devoted to this in Matthew. So we've got about a minute, maybe 2 minutes to go, so let's see what we can do with this. There's the Beatitudes, and I'm going to summarize those in just a moment. And then there's the woes section. That section, 24 to 26, that we just noticed, is mentioned here, but not in Matthew's account. But it's the opposite of what we see in the Beatitudes. Woe to those who are poor. That is, talking about who are spiritually destitute. They're spiritually bankrupt, and theirs would be the kingdom of heaven. Those who are spiritually hungry, those who weep, that should say instead of will. I don't know why that happened, but those who weep, they're weeping for their sins, and blessed are those who are persecuted. Now, the woes are just the opposite. Woe to those that are rich. They don't recognize their poverty. Woe to those who are full. They don't have the hunger. Woe to those who laugh. They're not weeping for their sin. Woe to those who, when all men speak well of you, you're not living the kind of life that causes you to be persecuted. You see, it's just the opposite. Does that make sense? Up and down, yes. Back and forth, no. Time is short. All right. Now, let's go back to and finish the rest of the sermon. Now, starting at verse 27, being good and loving to all, this is at the end of chapter 5 of Matthew. And so, in Matthew, the point is the righteousness of the kingdom goes further than the Old Testament law. That's his point. So love all men. There's to be love for all. Let's jump down to verse 36. Therefore be merciful just as your Father is merciful. Matthew's account mentions that as being perfect. Be perfect as he is perfect. Not flawless, complete is the idea. Be complete in your love. Then verse 37 gets us to chapter 7 of Matthew. Judge not that you be not judged. The hypocrisy. Now, that hypocrisy, 39 and 40, is inserted here that's not found in Matthew's account. So there are a couple of things here about the blind leading the blind, both falling in the ditch. Now, Matthew may mention that, but not in the context of the Sermon on the Mount. It's talking about their hypocrisy. And then starting at verse 43 is what we call the invitation section of the sermon. That starts in Matthew chapter 7 in verse 13. And so he ends on the note of obedience. And we're going to have to stop with that right there. Questions or comments in the last 30 seconds? I know that's a hurried look, but the more thorough study of the Sermon on the Mount is going to be found Matthew 5, 6, and 7. We're going to stop right there.